Hello and welcome to the Twined Estate Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Twined Estate is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. This will be the second iteration of our talk on education. And here we are in our Sunday show, the idea being that we don't take calls and we dive a little bit deeper into fewer topics in the hopes of getting to some really juicy content. You can find a link to the live chat at the official website, declinefm.com, and the live chat is a great way to bring up points for discussion on the Sunday show. For a more leisurely but less interactive experience, plug in Decline State on iTunes. Links to our live stream and archive episodes can be found at both Decline FM and r/declineestate at reddit.com. I'm Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of the Silicon Valley, and I'm going to hand it over to our handsome and at least one lovely co-casters for today and let them go around and introduce themselves.
Hi guys, this is Eternal. Ron, did you... sorry, I missed it. Did you talk about the Book of Boy at all?
I didn't bring it up. I thought it was more for our callers on the Wednesday show, but...
Well, I mean, we should still talk about it.
It's always a good thing to plug, please.
Yeah, so to our listeners, we are giving away one free copy of Everything Voluntary, and that is a book by, I think, Skylar J. Collins. Am I getting the name right there? And, and we're going to give that away free of charge. You just have to call in during our Wednesday show, and we'll have a raffle in a couple weeks and decide who the lucky winner is. And this is Eternal.
I am Toasty Time.
This is Rotto here, broadcasting from the heart of Silicon Valley, notwithstanding what Ron McCall may say.
And this is Shiny, broadcasting from the other side of Rotto's table.
All right. Yeah, so today on the docket, we got our second episode regarding education. As you guys who listened to the previous show are aware, we spent the last show on Sunday talking about the problems with public education, a bit of history on where it came from, and why the state decided that it needed to get involved in education. We came to the conclusions that, of course, education is done not for the sake of actually educating people, but more of a means for controlling the youth and promoting obedience and structure in society. And of course, we are not a big fan of promoting a sea of robots for the elites in government to control. So, we don't enjoy public education at all. So we're going to offer a bunch of different solutions and ideas on how we might approach education, not through the state, but through private, either for-profit or non-profit education systems. I think that that about sums up what we talked about last time. Did I miss anything big?
Nope, sounds just fine to me. And if we want to, jump right in...
Yeah. Let's jump right in. So I guess the first item, do you want to talk about that, Jay?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, we want to talk about alternative learning methods today. And so the first thing to note is that while the most common form of education is in public schools, I mean, there are a ton of other ways that people learn. And we want to begin with sort of just the basics of that, whether it's tutoring, weekend classes, internet resources, you have Khan Academy. You can teach yourself. In fact, I think that the majority of learning is done, on your own. And, there's the fancy word for that, autodidactism.
It's not a dinosaur.
No. just, I guess, Latin or Greek roots right there. Auto, self, didact, educating. And, there are tons of other alternative resources. And there's even unschooling, which I'm personally not too familiar with, but I'm sure somebody else here is. So we can just start from the top if somebody wants to get into these.
Sure. I also wanted to interject. There's a couple more things. Of course, we also didn't mention apprenticeships and sort of this a trade school type learning that used to be done way more back in the day and is still done today in the trade schools. We have an apprentice and a master and you have this kind of pupil and master relationship.
Well, tell us a little bit more about apprenticeships, please.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So in apprenticeships, basically what happens is you have, instead of one person going to school and learning, you know, through maybe a lot of book knowledge, a lot of presentations and lectures, and maybe a little bit of lab work or hands-on experience, and then going out into the field maybe 2 or 4 years later, and then finally getting some real job experience and real-world experience, assuming they didn't get any lucky internships or something. The apprenticeship model is, well, from day one, you go to work. You're working full-time from day one, and you go and you work beside and under someone who's experienced in the area. For like a mechanic, you'd work, you know, alongside a senior mechanic or electrician or a plumber or blacksmith or whatever.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, and the idea is there's none of this classroom experience. You're not wasting time talking about things you'll do in the field. You just do. And you simply learn mostly through imitation, getting to see what it's really like, seeing how people do things in the real world. And of course, you get to, you know, directly imitate and learn based upon that, the real world way of doing things. And it, for people who, of course, are not great classroom learners, which many tradesmen are not, it's really a great way to get people that hands-on experience that they need, which is directly relevant rather than indirectly relevant to the work they're going to do.
This is fascinating. This reminds me of actually, it reminds me very much of my school. This is going to sound very weird because we're not supposed to talk about, you know, we're talking about apprenticeship, right? So you wouldn't expect that in school you would get something like an apprenticeship, right? So, well, I had the benefit of a private school, and the private school had pretty interesting education programs in the school. And one of them, everybody had to actually do it, at least for 2 years. It was not an elective subject. It was shop. Shop consisted of metalwork and metalwork only. It wasn't wood shop or anything like that. And they'd have like expensive machines and things like that, right? Like mills and bandsaws and bench drills and things like that that are very, very dangerous if you don't know how to use. And of course, we all had our share of accidents. I once sliced the tip of my finger off using a band. I'm not remembering what the name of the machine is, but it was pretty bloody that day. In any case, it was very scary. Well, I thought it was very scary. I was like 12 or something. We would learn with the teachers in an apprenticeship model. We would not be allowed to use the machines until we had learned how to use every single hand tool possibly under the sun and properly. These tools were actually difficult, especially if you're like 12. It's difficult to use a tool because you don't have the strength and you probably don't have the motor coordination necessary to actually file a metal piece properly or cut it using a hacksaw or something like that, or bend it using one of those bench thingies that bite the metal. I forget. I don't really know the name in English. But in any case.
Does it start with an R? Is it a reader
so.
Or something?
I'm not sure. It's like jaws that you close by turning something. It's like a press.
Gosh. I did some work as an electrician assistant for a while, and I'm trying to remember all my tools. I can't remember any of them.
The tools, they all were... You know what? It's very interesting, because after you've done something, you've finished with some project, right? Which, like, our first project was just to cut some squares out of aluminum sheet or something. No, actually, just thin sheet. Was it tin or was it just steel? I forget. But it was, like, really difficult to get them right, at least at the beginning. And then it became easier and easier, and you have to, you know, you develop an eye for getting a piece of work actually well done and well polished and with no mistakes. Because you can't make a mistake, right? If you cut too much, your piece is ruined and you have to start over. And you don't want that because, well... So you still get graded on the level and the quality of your work. I always got great grades. I actually loved it because of that. And then after you've learned to master the tools and get a feel and get an idea of how, you know, the metal that you're working with actually behaves under tension, stress, and other forces, then you get to use the big machines. And it makes sense, right? Because beyond the fact that the big machines are very, very dangerous, even just an air compressor is actually very highly dangerous. And I'll explain a little bit more shortly. You need to have a foundation as to, you know, how the thing that you're working with will behave on certain circumstances. And this goes beyond book learning. You can't just learn it by, you know, you can learn about the melting temperature of a metal, and that's fine if you want to pick up a book and learn about it. But you won't learn the specifics of how aluminum melts and how it'll behave when it's molten until you actually cast a piece using a sand model, which actually was fascinating too, and also very dangerous. Just like a little droplet of that molten metal, if you splash it onto somebody, will drill a hole in their in the flesh. It's horrible. Anyway, as I was saying, let's just quick trivia. If you blast some, you know, blast at somebody with the nozzle of an air compressor, you can give him an air embolism and kill him. One of the students did it to the other one, just you know, because he was trying to fool around playing. The teacher was so angry at this and made him write an essay, like 500 words, why should I do that? And then he learned, you know, about, you know, the danger of air embolisms and stuff. So it followed an apprenticeship model. However, it wasn't entirely apprenticeship, and especially, you know, because you don't get paid for the work you do. You just basically do it because it's fun, or it's interesting, or it's an assignment or something, or whatever. And
right, so
taught us
if I can
so
butt
much.
In, actually... I just wanted to point out for any listeners that, you know, the whole mode of apprenticeship in general appears all the time in society. I mean, whether it's children learning how to do yard work from their parents. I mean, parents, of course, want them to get extra work done, so the parents teach the children how to do yard work or whatever, and that's just sort of a way for children to learn how to do it, and then they can begin doing it themselves. It's a form of learning. I think it even happens whenever, like, a great example is when I was in high school. You know, I ran around with sort of a group of other kind of computer nerdy kids. That was just the clique I was in. And, you know, one of the things we would do for fun really was to learn how to do programming, learn new computer languages. And, of course, there was sort of like a tutoring hierarchy where you had more experienced geeks helping out the less experienced geeks. And that, too, is sort of an apprenticeship model where you're just simply learning one-on-one from somebody who knows the practice a lot better. And, I mean, that was far better. I mean, even though it isn't career-motivated, I think that's a far better way to learn than, okay, sit in a class, go through the computer science curriculum. So, yeah, Eternal, you had something to say?
Yeah, well, I mean, going off of the computer stuff, I think that anyone who has done any sort of programming, either kind of recreationally or professionally, knows that the majority of programming work, majority of computer stuff, is this mixture of autodidactism. Pterodactylism, whatever. And this sort of advising or question and answer type of tutoring, where the more experienced people share their knowledge with the noobs, the less experienced people, and often you'll get like tutorials or like there's a lot of forums out there where you can post up questions and people will answer them, and it's a big community of people that help each other out, because nobody can know everything. It's way too much stuff. So you have to have this kind of open knowledge sharing, and people who do know share with other people that don't know to get anything done, and that's how learning has to take place. And nobody learns programming from a book. Like, you and I know this from first-hand experience. I think everybody in this chat has some sort of programming experience and knows that you do not learn programming from sitting in a classroom or reading a book. You just go out there and you do it.
I would like to verify that. I would like to say that, yes, that's correct. Anybody who says that has learned programming from a book is lying to you. If he got a book and if he's using the book, he's only using it as a reference material or a tutorial. the learning of the programming is actually about learning how things fit together. Books are great at giving you reference when you need to know how some kind of idea or gizmo or thing in programming works, but they won't teach you programming. They will only teach you at best how a certain thing works, so you can then take that thing in the programming realm and use it for whatever goals you have in your program that you're writing.
Exactly. And it's all about arming you with different tools and getting familiar with how to use those tools. The specifics, like in programming, we talk about this thing called syntax, which is how every little, routine or function works, and all the various, punctuation things you have to throw in there to make it do things correctly, and what arguments you got to send it. And, when we talk about something like syntax, you get familiar with some of the basic stuff, but most of that stuff is things you look up in references. It's more so the idea or the way of thinking about programming that is something you have to learn.
Correct.
By just doing it. It's all about getting the mindset of an architect, a program architect, to be able to think like, okay, this is what I want to do. This is how I divide it up into different little blocks, and this is how I make those blocks in code. And
yes.
That's a way of thinking about putting really diverse ideas into structure, and being able to take that structure and make it out of something concrete, something real, which,
correct,
of course, is your programming language. That applies to all sorts of things, not just computer programming. That's pretty much how the human mind creates things.
Yep. For example, there's people who say, all right, I have learned to program in this new programming language called Python because I picked up this book called, Teach Yourself Python in 21 Days. Just the name of the book already tells you it's teach yourself. It's not learn from this book, right? It doesn't say Python, learn here. It says teach yourself. And the way the methodology of the book teaches you how to program is, it teaches you to go through examples and then variations of those examples. So you get an idea of what change here or what change there has what effect, right? Which is the scientific method. You just do it in front of a computer. So, and even then, you're not teaching yourself how to program. You're teaching yourself a language. The how to program thing is just the question of teaching yourself how to reason, how to think about things, how to be logical. And there is a very, 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 very contundent, there's a very, very solid set of evidence, a body of evidence in computer science research that demonstrates that people who don't have this ability to reason about things just can't program. They just cannot program. And our audience will be ecstatic to know that there's a paper out there that you can search. It's on the web, and you can immediately find it if you type it on Google. It's named The Camel Has Two Humps, and it has experimental evidence that demonstrates that the people who actually pass programming courses already knew how to program fundamentally. They only learned the syntax of the language or whatever is it that they're learning in their programming courses. But the logic, the thinking about how, to program and making machines work instead of actually trying to guess what the machine is doing and bumble about, is something that is learned. It's something that is learned way before programming per se, and it's something that some people just can't learn. They seem not to be able to learn. Of course, they're already adults, so it's a little bit harder to learn, right?
Yeah, and I think you see the same thing in math education also, because the way math education is taught is that, this is the algorithm to solve a problem that looks like this. When in reality, you need the reasoning skills, you need to build up sort of a how to form algorithms, whether it's a math problem or a programming problem. And it has to be self-motivated. It has to be you teaching it to yourself. And of course, that's not what you get in classroom education. But, if you're using math in whatever field it is that needs it, then you're actually going to, learn the logical processes for yourself. And, of course, that aids future education.
Yeah, I think that most importantly, we can take this kind of approach of using more of this, I can't pronounce the word, self-learning. Pterodactylism, whatever. I'm just not going to try. But we should, you know, take that kind of approach of having this self-learning through experimentation and this overarching kind of body of references, whether that's people or just simply material, and apply that to more than just the mathematics and computer architecture, just areas of study, and maybe approach that with something like English. Like, think about your writing classes, your English classes. Like, what were they like? They certainly weren't something where it's like, okay, here's what we're going to do today, class. We're just going to sit down and you can write a story that kind of looks like this. You know, so, write a quick novel that's about, you know, 100 pages and, you know, go. And then we'll go ahead and review them at the end, or kind of do some reviews every week or something like that. And we'll see how it goes, and I'll help you guys get better, and you can come to me with questions. That's not what we did. But I think that that kind of system would make people much better writers. Well, I say quick novel, but you in a college-level class, that's not unreasonable. You know, writing, say, like 100 pages in a semester.
Well, you can write a story, right? You can, in class, write a story that is a short story or an ultra-short story, and then have other people review it. I mean, that's actually a very, very valuable mechanism for learning and for learning from other people, right? Just do something and the other person does something else, and then you cross and change papers and review each other. And as long as there's no mentality of perverted incentives, right? When there's, you know, it's the grade that matters, and then, you know, you give me a good grade if I give you a good grade so we can fool the teacher. As long as these perverse incentives aren't there, it can work very well, because if you know, you have an interest in learning and the other person has an interest in learning, you can both safely assume that you guys both have interest in learning. So you're teaching each other honestly and with an interest and with an eye to, you know, getting the other person to learn more.
There are courses like this in schools. Even in high school, I had one, which are courses in creative writing. I feel like the way courses are often structured as difficult, like Reno said, but there are other things such as, you know, extracurricular creative writing groups, where you basically go and, you know, a teacher will lend their ear and a bunch of other students will come. You'll either have a prompt in class or bring in something you've written out of class and either pass someone else to read or do a dramatic reading in front of the class, like in the case of poetry, and then you end up getting a lot of feedback from people to correct what you've written. And I've been in both a creative writing class and in a creative writing extracurricular activity. I actually feel like being in class was surprisingly helpful in that, you know, there's an external motivation to write.
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar class, I guess, my third year of college. I mean, it was titled like an academic writing course, but, and, you know, the way they actually got you to write about things you cared about was just to let you, you know, they would never tell you what topic to write about. It was supposed to be writing geared towards an academic audience, and, you know, so as, I mean, I was a math major myself, so the project I did was writing sort of an entertaining math text to people who aren't themselves mathematicians. And that was maybe the best class I've taken in college, because it let me guide myself, learn on my own, learn through pairing up with some grad students they had also in the class who were themselves English majors. And it gave, you know, a huge amount of experience.
Well, I believe that the fact that these types of courses work is because of a reduced perverse incentives. Of a reduced set of perverse incentives, right? The incentives that take away the fun of learning and take away the inventiveness of children and turned it into a rat race that is about getting the best grades, because otherwise you won't be able to get a job in the future. That kind of thing. What do you guys think?
Well, I definitely agree with that. Certainly in high school, the way things are structured now is that you know, everybody's a winner, everybody gets A's. And have you looked at what the GPAs are coming out of high schools now? It's like 5.0, 6.0, 5.9 or something. Like, what the heck is that? Like, what happened to just being 0 to 4, and you earn what you get, and there's nothing fancy about it? I'm so incredibly, like, amazed at the, because it's called grade inflation, and it happens at colleges, too. You just have this thing where the A doesn't mean anything anymore, because everyone's so focused on getting good grades, and because teachers and professors want to get liked, and because they're starting to get, I get judged based upon the grades they give and how good their class performs, that they just hand out grades like candy. So the whole thing is like this self-reinforcing system of perverse incentives, as you say. And
I mean, to their credit, though, I mean, even college people, you know, who accept students into college, they know the grades are laughable, that they really have nothing to do with how smart or how good of a performer the student is.
But it wastes a lot of time and resources. Like, people are so focused. Yeah, people are so focused on grades instead of on learning. And I really, really think that getting away from a grade-based system of verification of skills. There's a particular word, assessment. That's it. A grade-based system of assessment, and moving towards more of a skills-based system of assessment. Would really improve the way education is done, either in a classroom setting or just externally.
Hey, you said assessment. Okay. On a more serious note, my inner child is very active today. What I'm trying to say is, can you give us more examples of assessment that is actually, examples that people in the audience can, take and use in their practical lives when they're evaluating somebody? Remember that assessment applies to everybody. It doesn't just apply to students. You can probably use it to, evaluate whether an employee or a possible, business partner is going to be good for the business.
Well, the markets have their own form of assessment. It's called profit and loss. It's called, prices.
Correct. But that assess, that is actually, you're correct. You're absolutely right. However, it doesn't assess the performance of the person before you have actually put that person in a position where he can impact profit and loss. And that's why if you have a business, you want to know ahead of time, to the extent that it is possible or to the extent that it is practical, if the person that you're going to put in charge of some responsibility is actually going to be able to increase that profit and decrease any losses, rather than the other way around, right?
Of course, yeah. I mean, you want to have some sort of, some sort of assessment.
Certifications. I mean, thing that other businesses do now is, recommendations,
Yeah, reputation. That's another thing. So, of course, when you talk about, well, how do we make sure that people have the necessary skills so that when they get hired by a place, the place knows exactly what they're getting into nowadays. I mean, a lot of it is they have a piece of paper from a university or they have recommendations from someone else in the field. I think the reputation recommendation system is a good system. I think getting a piece of paper from a university is not as good. I think it carries a lot less weight than it used to. And of course, that's because the government involvement and the bloat of the university system and higher education in general, the valuation and inflation of the degree. But, when we talk about getting things moving away from, grades as a system of assessment, I think a lot of it is having real demonstration of projects that work. And that's why I think when it comes to programming, for instance, I keep going back to this because I guess it's what I know, but programming is the program works or it doesn't. It kind of works a little bit. It's either it works, it compiles, and it does what it says it's going to do, or it really kind of just flubs and doesn't compile and it doesn't do anything it's supposed to. You do have a bit of gray area when it comes to more complex programs that have weird bugs and things that aren't caught. But when it comes to at least basic programs, it's either it works or it doesn't. And yeah, there can be better solutions, but getting things to work is a good way to demonstrate that you have some sort of skills and knowledge.
This, you know, that's true. That reminds me of something that happened to me a few days ago. I was in a job interview and I was writing code because, you know, you have to write code in a job interview for, you know, something that is even remotely related to programming, right? As I was doing it, I discovered a bug in my code and we were running short on time, so I couldn't actually fix it. But as soon as we, you know, finished our phone conversation, I fixed the bug. And I immediately sent, in less than a minute, I immediately sent it to my, you know, prospective new employer. Interestingly, what hampered my problem solving skills is that you don't get immediate feedback when you're in an interview because you're writing on a shared text pad instead of writing it on an application that will actually tell you, hey, what you're writing is sensible or not. So this feedback process, I think, is integral in, you know, both learning and problem solving. Without the feedback, you can't actually tell whether what you're doing is going to work in, you know, real life or not. And I think schools lack a lot of that. How can we introduce this feedback process into the education process, whether it's in a school or not?
That's very true. One way you can do it, and Toast will remember this, back when we were in elementary school, and this was the greatest, I didn't even realize how great an idea this was at the time, but it's a fantastic idea. We had this thing called Marketplace, where basically we would get all this money, fake money. It was, you know, it's useful as government money because you buy things with it. It didn't have any real valuation, but it was still useful. And we would all go to this marketplace, which is, you know, just a period in the week where we would all set up various booths and stuff and sell things that either we made or offer services to each other. And we would spend our money on different things. And we would bring things there that we thought that other people wanted. And it turns out that a lot of people were very successful in giving other students things they wanted. Unfortunately, there was this level of perversion where you would buy things with real money and then sell them for this fake money. So you could buy other things with the fake money. It was a little funky in that aspect.
And ridiculous inflation.
Yeah, the inflation was hilarious. But it was a really good way for, you know, kids who were, I guess we were like 10, something like 10, 11.
Yeah, right around there.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, kids who are not even out in the real workforce yet, who couldn't go out and really learn a lot of skills to get real world experience in what is effectively a marketplace and learn what, and to learn how to produce a product that other people wanted, where they didn't have to really invest a lot of actual resources. It was a great way to get people to learn about giving other people what they want rather than just doing things that they themselves may have wanted to do, and to how to react to profit and loss.
Well, do you think that actually tied into the previous point about sort of immediacy of feedback? Because, I mean,
I do. Because you can take that kind of model where you have a marketplace type model, and if you set the incentives right, if you get everything set up in such a way that there's no perversion from outside resources, or at least you minimize it, what you can do is you can set it up so students will share their work with other students, and they will literally like trade with each other for some sort to, and they want to produce really good stuff so they can get other people's really good stuff.
I traded homeworks with my classmates in school, so I know a little bit about trade.
Yeah,
I just wanted to point out that in the program Eternal was just mentioning, I actually invested in other people's businesses. I was like a fifth grader, and I was a venture capitalist.
I want to say something, but I'm not going to say it.
Yeah, no, he's about to make a Jew joke. Yeah. Okay,
oh my God.
But...
No, it's great, though. I mean, we had people who would actually make food at home and bring it in and sell it to the rest of the class. Like, that's pretty much what people do in real life. I mean, a lot of people have, like, these little home kitchen businesses that, you know, they just operate out of their, you know, some home kitchen and sell sandwiches or whatever the heck they make. Pies.
Agorism. But anyway, agorism. It works. See? It works.
Now, I think the better thing that came out of that program was actually fostering some positive characteristics in the children. I mean, maybe not fostering it, but let them develop these characteristics themselves. You know, things like ability to take failure in stride, ability to meet other people's needs, to actually, like, you know, communicate with other people and find out what it is that they want. Because, you know, that's actually the hardest thing in a programming career, is figuring out what your client wants out of you. And, you know, the ability to set their own goals, and then being rewarded in a timely fashion if it works out.
Oh, dear God, figuring out what people actually want is like 90% of the work. It is so hard to figure out exactly what you're supposed to do with yourself in the
right.
real world.
And pair that with the fact that, like, most programmers are your INTJ types that aren't exactly great at communicating with people to begin with, so then it just compounds.
Well, think about it. There's also the huge barrier that somebody who wants to provide value to anybody else in the world has to overcome, and it is, what things is he allowed to do that the law would otherwise prohibit, right? So maybe somebody says, all right, so I want to be a manicurist because I think it's a cool job and I get to talk to a lot of people and he pays enough money that, you know, I can make a comfortable living that way. And I don't want to have to worry about, you know, too much about having to learn 10 years of some kind of education and stuff. Nope, you can't, because you need a license. Why do you need a license? Because the state requires your license. Now, let's not explore why the state does that, but I think everybody here knows that, right? And everybody knows why that happens. But the point is, they make you go to a beauty school or something, and that will last 2 to 3 years instead of what in an apprenticeship setting could last maybe 1 or 2, and you could be making money while you're in the apprenticeship setting, whereas with the school that will give you the piece of paper, the certification, the license to actually practice, you will actually be paying money instead of making money.
So, I want to expand on that point, of course, which is why a lot of us say that people going to college now are throwing their money away, because they could be going to work and learning some skills on the job, I mean, doing something like an apprenticeship for a plumber or electrician. I know you have to go to trade school and get certifications for that too, but I mean, there are some jobs where you don't have to get any real certification. I mean, you could be, I don't know, if there probably are licensing for like florists and all sorts of other things, gardeners, landscape workers. There's certifications for everything these days, but certainly less classroom time. And is a lot cheaper than a traditional four-year education. And you get out there and you're working and making money, even if it's not a lot of money, you're actually making money rather than for 4 years losing money, making nothing, and then coming out and getting the same job you would have had anyway because your degree is worthless.
But you can't make money. I mean, that's the thing, right? It's the other restriction here that is at play is, hey, you can't actually do apprenticeship because an apprentice cannot be paid what a fully capable professional is going to be paid, right? So he's going to be paid less, you know, he's going to be paid not enough money to maybe not survive, but at least some money would be good. But then again, minimum wage swoops in and ruins that. What about
that? Yeah, minimum wage is a big problem. Certainly, I mean, you see this in the inner cities. You have a lot of companies that would love to be able to pay just like $3 or $4 an hour. I mean, just it's kind of, you know, bad wage. But they would love to be able to pay, you know, a bunch of young kids with no real skills whatsoever and, you know, can't even really read or write or do math or anything. And just pay them, you know, maybe to, like, you know, unload boxes or something, you know, to just do some really basic work and then maybe get a few skills on, like, working with customers or registers or just teaching professionalism, for crying out loud, like anything like that. And, you know, pay them $4 an hour to do so. And these kids, you know, don't have any jobs, no prospects whatsoever. Their education in public schools is atrocious. So this is a great option for them. It's a win-win. Minimum wage says, no, you can't do that. That'd be exploiting them.
Yeah. And so
the unemployment for...
Oops,
I was going to say the unemployment for black youth in major cities is something like 50%.
It is terrible, yes. And so what do the leftist stereotype people say about this? Well, you need to give them more opportunities. Okay, so you have basically, you, if you're in a conversation with them, what you have to tell them is you have taken away the possibility for them to actually work, even if they're going to make very little money. So what other chances are there? Well, they could go to college and get a 4-year degree. Aha. And so how are they going to go to college if they have to pay a fortune that they don't have and nobody wants to give them money because, of course, there are incredibly high risks for paying back that debt, right? So they can't work and they can't study. Effectively, they just cannot study beyond high school, even if they graduate, which it's very unlikely that they will, right? And so what do they do after that? Of course, they sell meth. What else are they going to do, right?
But yeah. So, like, drug dealing gangs actually have room for advancement, right? I mean, it's actually meeting the needs of customers. It's something where you actually get feedback relatively quickly.
Yeah, it's true.
Give
I mean,
people what they want, right?
It is a business, but I remember seeing this is a bit of a tangent, but I remember seeing I think it was a TED Talk by, it's the guy who does Freakonomics. And he was talking about...
Just about to reference this.
Yeah, because they did some research about the organization structure of the drug gangs, of gangs in general. And the way it works is the people at the top do pretty darn well. They make a good upper middle class living, maybe even better in a larger gang. But everyone else basically is screwed. I mean, there is no real room for advancement, but there's at least the hope of it. And people are sucked into that hope and get stuck, you know, making $7 an hour, you know, and then maybe have their side job at McDonald's or something, and that's their life. Because it's the only way they can advance, because all the other options, all the other bottom rungs in the ladder are cut off from them. And, you know, it's really sad to me that's their best option. And they're rational agents. I mean, these are rational people. They're not stupid. They're just reacting to the world around them as they see it.
Agreed. How do we solve this? I mean, just like in my view, there's like, it's a systemic problem and it's being aggravated from every degree and every angle, right? Let's think about it. Taking away minimum wage would help. Bringing back apprenticeships would help, right? So we have two solutions there that we can quickly implement if it weren't for the political problem that the solutions carry. And the idea that students can also learn in schools that are cheap, again... That's another problem that we discussed in the last show. The prices of schools. Again, government created problem. Make schools cheaper. That's one thing that we need to focus on. Is there any other solutions Tell me.
I remember. I think it was on Stossel's special, "Stupid in America." I think he had one teacher who, instead of just teaching the kids he had. All the textbook stuff, instead of playing by the rules, he had them go ahead and talk about starting their own businesses. He talked about entrepreneurship. He talked about, getting some sort of business together and selling things at a profit and saying, you guys can offer real service to real people. And he got kids to go out there. You know, these are like fairly uneducated, you know, lower class inner city black kids. Who have very little future, according to the traditional public education system, and he got them to go out there and start businesses and make real money, and a lot of them were very successful. They would open food carts or even simple things like shoe shining. I mean, they're actually getting out there and providing a service, and they're learning about these things at such a young age that by the time they get out to 22, 23, when most kids graduate college, they're an experienced professional. And they understand the real world. They can go out there and expand their businesses, hire other people.
Oh, yeah. I wish this happened more often. I wish there was like a million John Stossels or people like him helping others do this thing, right? But there isn't. And nobody, the kids are not getting informed about the possibilities that they actually do have right at their fingertips because it is in their interest. Sorry, in the interest of the people who are going to profit off of them unfairly from their ignorance and from their obedience, not to tell them, right?
What strikes me about the business ideas that you mentioned are that all of them are things that are off the grid. I know San Francisco people will know what I'm talking about, but for example, the food trucks, the shoe shining, all of these things are things that sort of pass under the government radar and are largely unregulated, some of them not for lack of trying, but they seem to provide much more reliable avenues for success for people who have limited opportunities because of their socioeconomic status. Food trucks included, shoe shining included, other things that one can run as a quote-unquote small business without ever establishing a business in terms of a corporation.
Yep, and most of these things actually, most of these businesses are run exclusively off of cash. And what characteristic does cash have that government doesn't like. And that's very simple. It's easy to make. Well, you know, it's easy to make if you're, you know, it's easy to get cash, and it's very hard to tax it. So unless you have a business that is regulated and registered with the government and that has to present receipts, you know, and bills and stuff like that and paperwork, it's going to be very, very hard to tax it. So the government, so anybody who works at government has a direct incentive to sabotage these kinds of businesses. And therefore, these people who are actually entrepreneurs that are working off the grid are under constant threat that their business is going to go up in a plume of smoke when the government swoops in and says, you know, you're not allowed to do this. Why do you think cities have regulations that don't allow like food carts in certain places and stuff like that? Basically, almost anywhere, right? Or running your own business from the street. It's because these businesses are usually difficult to tax. And so since they're difficult to tax, the city mayor, the government, they just perceive them as a threat to their, to their pockets. It's a threat to their pockets, and therefore they need to be suppressed.
And also the property taxes that you don't get to collect from having a brick and mortar business. I mean, if you're a company that just operates out of like a truck, you don't have to pay property tax on a brick and mortar, you know, piece of land, building a piece of land. That's a huge amount of revenue the locality misses out on. So they love banning that stuff.
Yeah. And this is also why there's so many regulations that prohibit you from conducting businesses in your house. Some of them are zoning laws. Some of them are not zoning laws. They're just city ordinances. All kinds of city ordinances. The point is, if you don't have an established business with paperwork and stuff like that, blah, 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 where the government gets to control your business because they really do own the business because it's a creation of the government, then you're basically screwed. They can shut you off, shut you down anytime.
Yeah, and I guess the way this all ties together is this shows how the things that are off the grid, this shows how the things which are, you know, not part of the major system of, well, let's pump kids out of public schools into major corporations and colleges and get them, you know, through the education system. This is how people actually become successful. This is what America is really about. This is the whole idea of the American dream, that you'll just kind of go out there and make yourself successful by doing your own thing. And, you know, how can we apply this as a general system to education? How can we take this idea of operating in this kind of distributed manner where people are more self-motivated and working off the grid to education in general? I think a lot of that has to do with the most wonderful invention of, you know, the last 100 years, I think, the internet. It's all about internet education these days. It's all about having a distributed system of education that is off the radar. And if you don't have a brick and mortar building, if you're running things through an online system, it's a lot harder to track and regulate and control it.
So do you mean something like MIT's open courseware or like the Khan Academy?
I think that those are great options for their respective tiers of education. I think the MIT open course and other, I think Stanford does it as well. A lot of colleges are starting to slowly move in that direction of offering some of their material online and open. That's a really good way to get some more specialized content. Khan Academy is fantastic for, I would say, like very basic up through junior high kind of education. It's a good resource. It's a great tool for people to simply go and learn about a subject really quickly, and it's not boring. I mean, they make it pretty interesting. I like a lot of the videos they have, and I think that they do a good job with some things, but there's a huge market out there for a lot more diversification in education. I think there's a huge market for math education and logic that Khan Academy is not very good at.
Why? We need to teach everybody logic, for the love of God. That is the one thing that is the most important thing that nobody gets taught in school.
I think that a lot of the market that isn't easily addressed by online and video courseware is easily addressed by tutoring. And I know this probably applies to some of you. I've been a tutor, and what I often did was either one-on-one teaching for individual students who were either struggling in school or who were bored in school by how easy it was. So I've done tutoring in math and in programming, both of which are things that are easy to learn as an individual without a whole lot of tools, but do require a basic introduction that some people find it hard to receive through a video, or need a little more structure, a little more feedback.
Yeah, I mean, I've done tutoring too, but one of the problems is that, I mean, at least with the sort of agorism approach to education where we just need to provide better resources than the government does, part of the problem is still, at least when I was tutoring, that students are in a hurry to get out because they've already gone through all of their classes. They don't have any time left to really sit down and learn and appreciate the material. Even though they want to, they're just completely out of time to do it. So, I mean, while agorism has certainly helped me learn far better than any classroom ever did, I still think you're fighting, you know, the time problem.
Oh, you certainly are. I feel like there are ways to combat that in tutoring, though. For instance, if you teach someone who currently, you know, has this intense hatred for learning, which some people certainly develop coming out of school, they translate their hatred for school to a hatred for all learning. If you can undo that, you make that student a lot happier to keep coming back to you and keep learning, even though they have other things to do with that time. And while it's definitely true that you're fighting against students' sort of unmovable obligation to be in school for those 8 hours or 9 hours a day, which is hard to combat, you can often be saving them a lot of time, like the time that they spend on homework. You can save them by tutoring. And you can sometimes even get to the point where students view the tutoring as something that they do in their free time because it's that fun. Like, especially if the tutoring is sort of guided by the student as opposed to being remedial for a class. Like people who come and say, you know, I really want to learn how to program a game. And, you know, they'll freely do that as a leisure activity rather than something that competes with school at all. And I think that's one way that can really succeed in teaching, is in making it very distant from school, being, you know, about someone who says, you know, I really want to learn this, and they want to learn it so much that they'll give up their free time to do it.
So, Rutto, you had something to say, looks like?
No, not really. I mean, it's a... What can I tell you about this, you know? Come to think of it, I don't have much to say about that. I think I agree with it.
Okay, well, I think it might be useful to discuss some of the things that actually make some people seem to really want to learn. And some people seem to have a tendency that they embrace learning, that they learn by themselves, that they approach other people to ask to be taught, whereas some people come out with a sense that education or learning as a whole is worthless for them. And I think there are a couple things that go into a sort of learning mindset that are really important. The major thing that I can think of is curiosity, sort of, they're just people who want to know how things actually work, and the goal of being a builder, I think, is also very important in people who want to learn. People who want to create something, some kind of product that they can own. And both of those are very powerful drivers in people who have this learning mindset.
Yeah, I mean, personally, it's hard for me to connect with, like, the need to draw curiosity out of, you know, a student, just because myself, I mean, I kind of saw some artistic beauty in the math I was learning in college. I enjoyed programming just for the sake of the challenge, but that's not something most people, I guess, have the advantage of feeling. I mean, do you, either of you, have any sort of ideas on how to bring that out?
I think this is something that's pretty much fundamental in most people, that they have this curiosity and they have this desire to try new things. And I think that part of it is that, not that people don't come with this curiosity, but for one thing, everyone's curiosity is guided in different directions. Some people are very, very curious, say, about machines, and some people couldn't care less, but they simply adore living things. And you have to find where someone's curiosity is. And in a lot of cases, they've had that curiosity basically crushed out of them by the educational system that they've been through. And often you are able to access it by going through something that doesn't feel like learning. So with particular students that I had, especially students who their parents had brought to me because, you know, they were failing in math or something, and I never start by giving them math. We play games that are mathematical. And, you know, you bring in something that, look, let's play this fun game, and, you know, after the kid starts to really like the game, you know, surprise, this game was math all along. And at that point, the student can get past their sort of feeling of, but I don't like math, because they've realized that it is somewhere within them to actually like math in one of its forms. And that can often put them back on the right track toward looking for things in math that they like, as opposed to viewing it as basically a flop in its entirety.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the mandatory nature of forced schooling, you know, starting at the age of 5 usually, is really beating, I mean, figuratively, I suppose, beating the creativity right out of kids. I mean, if you think about how kindergarten is structured, at least where I am in public school, I mean, it's just, you block, every single thing is blocked out. You know, now is when you're going to play with, like, glitter and glue and pipe cleaners, and this is when you're going to sing the songs and whatever, and nothing is self-guided. And, you know, at the age of 4, before the children go into kindergarten, I mean, every parent, I mean, I'm not a parent myself, but every kid goes through their phase where they just ask why after every single statement you make. And, I mean, there's just this inquisitiveness that just suddenly stops at the kindergarten age, it feels. And, I mean, the only thing I can think is that, like, it's because they're in an environment where you really can't ask why. You know, the child just does what the teacher says. And those are the values which are encouraged, not, you know, asking why.
This is too true. This is completely too true. And I think that a lot of sort of what you can give back to a student, if you have access to them while they're in school, is sort of reigniting that self-driven learning. And it seems kind of funny because I'm saying, you know, tutoring can help people who aren't doing very well learning on their own, but it can, because a lot of what they need help with is becoming self-driven again. And I say becoming that again because I feel like most babies are totally self-driven to begin with. And it's basically, they're taught that that's not okay by being put into the sort of regimented system. And you know, they need to learn that it's okay. And not only is it okay, it's fun and makes you feel accomplished.
Roto, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, as Shiny said, the idea that kids get their curiosity rooted out, their natural learning capacity rooted out, is not an accident. We've discussed this in the past show. I think it's one of the greater tragedies of our era. It's certainly one of the tragedies atop which the death of a 250 million people in the past century was built. And I wish it stopped. Of course, it doesn't take that much effort to stop this, right? The only effort that it takes is to actually provide honest education rather than schooling, right? Guys, have you thought about the idea of, I mean, how do you think unschooling can be made more effective in this case, you know? Because I understand that unschooling is very effective at preserving this curiosity, natural curiosity of human beings. How do you think it could be made more effective? And, you know, is there anything that we can do for parents who are unschooling to make their lives easier and to make their kids better, to help them make, you know, help their kids succeed?
Can you explain to us what is unschooling?
Well, the idea of unschooling is what, you know, the name would convey. It is the opposite of schooling. Instead of putting a kid into, you know, a class, we call them classes, right, into a class with 30 other students to bore them to death, you let the kid direct his own learning, right? You buy him books, you buy him tools, you let him explore and experiment and teach himself whatever he wants to learn at the pace that he feels like learning. And since it's more like play than structured education, or if there's structure, the structure is actually suited to the kid's needs, learning proceeds so much faster, and it just doesn't have this awful effect of teaching kids that learning is, you know, is boring and is negative and it should be avoided at all costs in favor, you know, in lieu of watching TV.
Right. Go for it.
So I feel like one of the main reasons why people don't get into unschooling, apart from being successfully brainwashed, that is they feel like they are unable to give the kid that form of education because they can't physically be present in the home. At this point, with the economy how it is, people feel like, you know, they can't afford to have one of the adults in their household not having a career. So I feel like one of the main things that could be done in terms of unschooling is maybe to arrange unschooling communities where we can get almost a very, very small, off-the-grid private school where maybe you have, you know, 5 neighborhood kids, all of them go to unschool at a different family's house each day of the week, and then, you know, each adult involved has one day off per week to teach unschool.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that could have happened in my own family's household growing up. My brother was homeschooled, and part of what that included was my mom, who was actually a stay-at-home mom, which is wonderful, and most parents really don't have that luxury. But if there is a stay-at-home mom, her time probably isn't completely taken up with just that one student, I think. And so, I mean, certainly maybe my mom could have volunteered herself to the community. Maybe there were some other parents who would have liked their children to be out of these public schools and in the hands of a neighbor whom they trusted. And that would be really fantastic, I think. I mean, that's sort of what you were describing, you know, very small scale private schools, just, you know, an educator with a couple students.
I mean, that kind of pedagogy is certainly a way to build the community as well. If you've noticed, like, at least in modern suburbia and the way people live nowadays, it's very isolated. The communities are not the way they used to be. It's not like this 1950s Pleasantville kind of small town atmosphere where everyone kind of knows each other, neighbors talk to each other, have each other over for barbecues and stuff. People don't do that anymore. People are reclusive. They don't talk to each other. Nobody knows who their neighbors are. I don't know my neighbors. I mean, I barely even talked to my neighbors back when I was living with my parents a long time ago. We didn't really interact with a lot of people in the neighborhood occasionally, but not. We were more active than most people, and still, I mean, so many people were just reclusive and didn't involve themselves in the local community. And I think bringing people together and building those strong community ties through this kind of reciprocal education system with homeschooling is a great way to strengthen the community, which is good in times of struggle, of course. I mean, bad economy, people can pitch together and help out someone who's, you know, having some hard times. They can pick up some slack and do some odd jobs for them that they can't afford on their own. Or, you know, if there's a disaster, everyone can pull together into one house that has power or water or something. You know, that kind of thing. People are not going to do that now. But certainly, the way the economy is going, the way things are going, a big disaster could cause real problems. The economy could really tank very suddenly, and people could find themselves kind of screwed and without a lot of food or, you know, a lot of resources and nowhere to work and get money. So having those community ties, I think, is a really important thing for everyone, especially families. And the homeschooling, kind of communal homeschooling system could be a great way to establish that.
I agree. It's certainly the case that people don't know their neighbors. They just don't. I mean, it's amazing. I think it has to do a lot with actually, you know, schooling and the fact that people have been continually divided by the actions of politicians who seek to divide them for their own profit, right? So they don't want to get to know their neighbors because, well, you never know. Maybe the neighbor is an evil person who is, you know, out to get me or something. And the less contact they have with them, you know, the better it is. This is especially true in urban settings. In suburbia, it's not so much that way. People tend to get to know their neighbors more than in the city. But I can tell you right away, I only have two neighbors that I know in my building. They're great people, by the way. And I got to know them because they were helpful with me. When I moved in, they helped me move in. Like, it was completely an accident that I found them on the hallway and I was moving all the stuff in. They helped me with everything. They didn't even know me. Of course, I don't need to tell you, these guys are not really Americans. They come from other countries. So why am I not surprised, right?
Yeah, definitely. You can see that with a lot of foreign communities. Like, I'm not a part of a foreign community, so I'm kind of speaking out my ass here. But I do know, like, my friends who are Indian, like, the Indian community, people just, like, know each other. There's this kind of, you know, same thing with the Korean community. People just know each other. The families all know each other somehow. And a lot of that may have to do with the religious institutions as well that they attend, as kind of community binding. And certainly in a lot of the big cities, you know, they're more liberal and less religious. And that's part of the reason why the community ties have broken down a little bit.
Well, to be honest, I'm an atheist myself, but I can't deny the social cohesion function that the churches and other religious institutions have. I won't deny that. It's true. And I'm fine with that as long as, you know, this cohesion doesn't produce, you know, xenophobia, which tends to do in some cases.
Yeah, certainly it can cause a lot of strange exclusivity in small towns where you have, you know, the two people that don't go to church are frowned upon and have bad reputations or something. You're like, why didn't you come to church yesterday? You know, you have to go every Sunday. You guys are sinning. You know, that kind of stuff. That's no good. But one point I wanted to make is, of course, especially when it comes to the urban areas, people, you know, have a tendency not to screw around with people that they like and know. I mean, you don't go and vandalize your neighbor's property if you kind of hang out at his house all the time. So the more you have these community, more you have this community binding, and the more the kids get to know the different families in the neighborhood, the more the kids get to experience, you know, different people and get the social experience and involvement in the community, the less likely they're going to grow up and be, you know, vandals. They're going to be delinquents and cause crime. You know, no one's going to go around slashing tires if that person's your teacher. Well, you know, unless they're a terrible teacher.
I don't know. I don't know if the person is your teacher, right? But if the person is your neighbor and you have a personal relationship with him, it's unlikely. It is we can write it off as fact that thieves and vandals do not rob and vandalize the people that they know. Unless they are sociopaths. Yeah, I mean, thieves, what does a thief do? A thief goes and searches for a stranger, a person that he won't feel bad stealing from. Is it true, or am I just talking out of my ass here?
I mean, certainly that's the case with, I would assume, a lot of robbers and muggings and theft in general, because people just steal stuff because they see opportunity. Obviously, when it comes to rape, though, you know, that's a little different. Rapists kind of usually know their victims and stuff. That's a little different story. But we're getting off topic at that point. But in general, I think that when you have that kind of homeschooling community, you know, we're definitely talking about bringing people together and reducing the amount of violence in society by promoting voluntary interaction and community. And to do this, this is why I'm such a huge fan of the Free State Project, because you need to have people that have the same goals in mind. You need to have the community looking towards cohesion. You have to get people to seek out that kind of voluntary relationship with their neighbors. And so it's important to get people who have this inclination towards voluntary interaction in one place so that you can build these strong communities. Because there are definitely some neighborhoods where that is not going to happen anytime soon. People just, they hate each other too damn much or something. I'm looking at our outline here, and I missed a little bit about what we were talking about. I don't know if we got into some of the topics, some of the talk about avoiding sticking kids in the same grades as each other. This is something I wanted to talk about. I might have missed that a little bit. Have we talked about separating kids by proficiency rather than age?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
I can speak on that if you would like.
Go for it. I've been
that just to me, that just seems like sort of an artifact of coercive schooling. Like, well, that's just, you know, how they decided at one point to make the schools, and now everyone considers that to be, like, just how it works. I mean, I just don't see how anyone can make an argument that there's value to keeping kids of, like, the exact same age together. I mean, understandably, you're not going to want too much of an age difference, but, you know, it just seems a little silly to me to expect, you know, people of the same age to be the exact same skill at everything. Like, that so actually sounds ridiculous.
It does sound ridiculous, doesn't it? And
any sort of free market education would just get rid of that, I think. I mean, of course, in the methods we discussed, whether it's apprenticeship or tutoring or, you know, homeschooling styles, I mean, that's just a non-issue anyway. I mean, it's just you hang out with somebody who's going to educate you better.
Yeah, and well, I was going to say, like, if you have a homeschooling group, for instance, you wouldn't want to stick all the 8-year-olds in the neighborhood together, all the 9-year-olds in the neighborhood together. You would probably want to have, like, this is, you know, this day, Wednesdays from 3 to 6 or something, or from noon to 3 is going to be our, you know, calculus day. We're going to learn calculus. It's going to be a math exploration day, and, you know, that will be the proficiency you're supposed to be at. And there'll be kids who are as young as maybe 8 or 9 who can go ahead and do that because they're just mathematical prodigies or geniuses, or at least just, you know, normal kids are going to be like that, you know, when you get them out of the jewel factories that are government schools. And you might have some kids who are just not very mathematically inclined, and, you know, maybe they're like 17, 18, or, you know, they're taking their time and they just want to get through and learn calculus because they kind of need it to do something in college, or, you know, they feel like it's necessary. Certainly there won't be a huge pressure to force kids into learning these kinds of things. I think that's going to be a big part of it as well, is kids will learn things when they're ready to learn them, rather than saying, learn now. Now learn the next thing. Now, I want to done with the last thing. I don't understand it. Learn faster. And, you know, this whole idea of no child left behind, you know, you got to get the kids through the program. Graduate them through the jewel factories on time. You can't slow down the assembly line. Go ahead.
Yeah, I feel like that's definitely something important that you touched upon, which is that students are required to learn particular things at particular times. And I actually feel like there are very, very few things in the world which people absolutely have to learn or they will completely fail as a human being. Like, perhaps reading may be one of those things. If someone doesn't know how to read, they're going to have an enormous amount of trouble navigating the world. But there are plenty of things that one simply doesn't have to learn. You know, if someone doesn't want to do anything to do with math, then it may be that they really have no reason to learn math. You know, they can have a calculator, you know, balance their checkbook for them. And, you know, so they simply don't need to learn those things.
What's a checkbook? Is that, like,
yeah,
that thing that old people use to keep track of money now that we have computers that young people don't use?
Yes, it's a historic artifact that people used to use before there was mint.com.
I just go onto my bank and just check, like, my statements that I made, you know, all the purchases I made on my check card. Like, remember that one, remember that one, remember that one. It's my balance. I'm good.
Yeah, or, like, my app on my phone that does the same thing, and it just tells me the balance. Like, how awesome is that? But that's still off topic. I mean,
well, I was going to say, like, it takes forever to balance a checkbook. And this is something that people used to think was a necessary skill Like, to survive in the world, you had to be able to balance a checkbook, and it's just something you had to learn.
Hey,
you had to have the skill to do it.
Some of us still believe that, man. Some of us still type in typewriters, too.
Man, you old geezers. Yeah, but I mean, really, like, because society has progressed, because we have technology now that can make it so easy to keep track of your finances, things like, you know, that app on your phone, Toast, we don't need to learn these skills, at least directly. We can still have the abstract knowledge that allows us to go ahead and learn those skills if we need them. You know, like the basic fundamentals of math are still there. But we don't need to actually learn how to balance a checkbook because we have tools to do it for us. And so education is something that needs to be very fluid. It needs to be more market-driven. And it needs to adapt to, you know, what we need to do in our real lives today. Obviously, you hear all the time, you know, education needs to be on the forefront. We need to be on the cutting edge. We need to be adaptive to today's changing economy or something. You know, we need to be more innovative and more technology focused or something. You hear that all the time from administrations and all sorts of school board members and politicians and such. We need to have a modern economy that's fueled by technology and it's ready for today's, you know, job market, not job market of 30 years ago or something. And this is government we're talking about. Government never changes. They're horrible about changing. They can't adapt to anything. There's no feedback through the price system, through profit and loss. So
they just adapt to whatever buzzwords seem to work at any given time.
No kidding. Have you guys noticed, like, literally every sentence that comes out of, like, some politician or major corporation these days has the word sustainable in it? Sustainable is like the number one most bullshit buzzword in existence right now. It's hilarious.
All right. Well, hey, to get back on topic, though, right before we wrap this up, I wanted to play a little devil's advocate here. What if we take some of the suggestions that have been made on this cast to heart, and let's say, like, coercive schooling ends, and we allow communities to take charge of the void for demand in education. So, what would you say if I made the argument that this is a bad idea because there are many bad parents out there that aren't going to teach their children or provide for their children's mental well-being adequately? So, what say you?
I'm gonna chime in first, simply because I've talked to my grandfather who was a music school teacher and later an administrator. He's now retired, but he and I have talked a bit about this, and I had talked about my ideas on schooling in general and getting, you know, maybe unions out of the public sector schooling and maybe reforming some of the education and even doing very small changes. He's like, no, none of that stuff actually matters. The most important thing is to get the parents get the parents to understand that the children need to be allowed to pursue their own future. The bad parents will destroy any system, statist or free market anyway. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, what happens if people are bad, well, it doesn't matter what system we have. People are bad, bad things are going to happen. And the most important thing we can do is to build up a stronger community and get the good people together to put societal pressure, to put that social pressure and ostracism on the bad people so that they feel it necessary to change their ways or maybe at least want to not feel like they're terrible parents and, you know, might want to shape themselves up and be a little better towards their kids. And certainly another big part of it is when you have this community-centric education, when you have this sort of education that is not forced and coerced upon kids, they're much more readily, I think they're going to be much more readily interested in seeing the success of other children and trying to attain that rather than when they're stuck together in one spot with all the other kids and seeing how they have it easy and they have it so hard, they're going to feel really bad about it because they're not keeping up with the rest of the kids in the public school system.
Yeah, okay. I mean, so to take it one step further, though, because community really is the solution that's being suggested, because communities, you know, well-structured communities can provide this service. I certainly agree. Do you think these communities exist to a great enough extent in like, for example, the United States, that a system like this could work in the near future?
I personally think that it depends on the area. Obviously, the United States is very diverse, and a small town in Mississippi that's pretty poor and has a lot of welfare state presence, I don't think there's not that much you can do for them, period. Your best option is the kind of... I think your best option at that point is to give the few people who do want to get out of there an opportunity to do so. When it comes to, of course, a larger city, you know, something like New York City, when you have a lot of opportunity there, a lot of people, a lot of diversity, that kind of community-focused system would work very, very well. Because there's a lot of people out there who are willing to provide the necessary structures, the necessary resources and opportunities to those who are not capable of doing that for themselves.
Yeah, when you ask, do these communities exist? You know, I don't necessarily think these communities exist, but I think the people who would be in them exist. And that a main problem that we have is how to organize. I feel like this is kind of a problem it obviously is a universal problem for any set of people, but it's a unique problem for our group, people who are of a libertarian leaning, people who are atheists, especially people who are anarchists, who are extremely, extremely individual focused and have learned, rightfully so, to be suspicious of all forms of communities, especially sort of insular and very deeply deeply entrenched communities that sort of run the whole vertical of people's social lives, because those communities have always betrayed these people, and these people sort of adhere to these deeply philosophical individualist views that they feel like, you know, they're rightfully wary of joining any such community. And it'll be difficult, not impossible, but certainly difficult for people like us to form a community where we can really trust each other.
Right, and so I guess that would be the appropriate time to yet again plug the Free State Project. You know, people who do think this way then can congregate there. And I'm sure this could take place up in New Hampshire.
I mean, I also want to say to our listeners in general, spread this idea around your friends and your family. Try to promote it as much as possible. Talk to them about these concepts and sort of, you know, plant the seed for, you know, getting this implemented in the future, because you know, we can't possibly move forward if people don't spread the idea. And I don't want it to be just the Free State Project. I don't want it to be just New Hampshire. I want this idea to be prevalent everywhere. And I want people to be open to these ideas and already be kind of exposed to them when they do go into effect in New Hampshire, so that people can look upon them and be like, yeah, wow, that actually really works. Let's try that here. I want it to be an infection. I want it to get stuck in the brains of everybody and just be back there like this little nagging voice saying, you know, free schooling, you know, free the children.
Yeah, I mean, hey, especially with the internet out there, I mean, the internet is best described as finally regular people getting together and comparing notes on what works and what doesn't work in society. That instead of just being able to listen to the experts' opinions on the TV box, you know, we can go on the internet and talk to each other about how well our own educations worked and figure out better ways to educate.
Yeah, there are, I wonder, see, I don't know this because I was never part of a big homeschooling or self-learning community. I know there probably are some good online resources for people who are interested in that. I don't know of any. Do you guys know any off the top of your heads? Any sort of communities online?
No, I mean, I'm sure unschooling communities exist. And if, you know, if they aren't extensive enough, I'm sure they will become extensive. But see, I can't give any plugs myself.
Well, I'm going to say, like, if there isn't something that everyone can go to as, like, the place to go where they can share ideas and participate in the conversation, if there isn't, you know, this big resource, maybe that's a market opportunity. Maybe someone needs to go out there and make something like this. Yeah, you know, because I'm just thinking right now, we're all part of Reddit. Reddit is a gigantic community where people get together and share, you know, either like-minded ideas, they're very specialized, or are very diverse, and they can share them with a lot of different people. And it's a good community tool in general. no one has this flaws. But something like that for, you know, this sort of libertarian style education. And I say quote unquote libertarian. You don't have to be a libertarian to still embrace this. You can embrace this if you just care about your children's education and care about learning. And you know, this kind of community doesn't seem to really exist, or I don't know of one. I would love if somebody could, you know, maybe post that to like the IRC or maybe to article into state and prove me wrong that something is out there so we can talk about it, because I don't know anything off the top of my head.
Yeah, no, there certainly is unschooling.org, and there are external links, and betcha that's going to get you where you need to go for that.
It's possible, yeah. So unschooling.org is this place for unschooling. Obviously, there's more than just unschooling, too, though, because there's homeschooling as well. I mean, I'm sure they have some stuff linked on there. But I would love to have a general open resource where, like, I know that there's places for different subjects, like physicsforums.com is a place where kids can ask physics questions to each other and get help on homework and such. That kind of resource is fantastic if used properly, of course, if there's a right incentives underlying. A lot of kids just abuse it to get their homework done by other people, but those kinds of resources can be really good, and I was hoping that there was something like that for just the general homeschooling community. It's something to think about, and certainly the internet allows people who are geographically diverse and across the entire world, not just even the United States or Canada, to come together and share their ideas and help each other out. Ron, you around?
Yeah.
How are we going to outro, man? We're totally lost.
I don't think we're lost. Are we? Oh my god. Oh crap.
We're doomed.
What are we going to do now?
I don't know. I guess we could continue talking about education some more.
Well,
just gotta keep going.
We can wrap it up if you guys want to. I can do that.
Yeah, I'm good to go.
All right. Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed our show. This has been a fantastic conversation. I think we are working together to make a better world, one topic at a time. This is the Decline to State Internet Radio Podcast, and we are signing off right now. Before we sign off, I'd like to remind you that we can be found, that you can listen to our shows at declinefm.com, that we have a live show that broadcasts at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Wednesday, that you can call into our show. And please do not forget, visit our subreddit at reddit.com/r/declinetostate and post the topics that you'd love to hear us covering the show. It's been great having you guys here, and it's been great discussing this topic. I'm going to leave everybody else to, you know, say goodbye.
Oh, and don't forget, Decline to State is brought to you free of charge. It is a voluntary show brought together by our love of liberty, as well as, capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. Yeah, got it.
Excellent. Well, guys, I hope you have a great night. This is Rotto signing out.
This is Eternal. Take care, guys.
This is Toasty Time.
And I'm Shiny. Thank you so much for listening today, and we'll see you next Wednesday.